There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LeBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I think you're just a person to give it to them. I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, sign up for our email newsletter. We have lots of information and commentary that we just don't have time to share here on the air, but we would love to share with you. So again, that's reconnectwithcarmen.com. You could also like The Reconnect on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LeBurge. All right, our lead story today really took place just after the show ended yesterday, and that is the news that Otto Warmbier has died. So Otto Warmbier, we have talked about him before here on The Reconnect, the University of Virginia student from Ohio who was detained in North Korea for nearly a year and a half. He died on Monday afternoon, just really not very long after he had returned home. You will remember that he returned home in a coma. He was arrested in January 2016 at the end of a brief tourist visit in North Korea. And so one of the questions that's certainly being asked, has been asked, will continue to be asked is why are Americans going to North Korea? And for some of you, you're thinking, well, people are going to North Korea because the North Koreans need the gospel and the North Koreans need our support. But to go to send young people there as tourists is certainly something that is being rethought. Let me read you a few outtakes from the Warmbier's statement related to their son, and then also a few things from President Trump. So this is from the Warmbiers. Unfortunately, the awful, torturous mistreatment our son received at the hands of the North Koreans ensured that no other outcome was possible beyond the sad one we experienced today. There has been a lot of outrage, as you might imagine. Well, a lot of intense political reaction, folks speculating what might should now be done, what we should do in retaliation. I think that President Trump, his statement was particularly poignant and appropriate. He said, "There's nothing more tragic for a parent than to lose a child in the prime of life. Our thoughts and prayers are with Otto's family and friends and all who loved him." He goes on to say, "Otto's fate deepens my administration's determination to prevent such tragedies from befalling innocent people at the hands of regimes that do not respect the rule of law nor basic human decency. The United States once again condemns the brutality of the North Korean regime as we mourn its latest victim." And we're going to get on to that subject here in just a second. But let me just go ahead and edit or clarify one thing about this statement. This is a tragedy from the viewpoint of this young man's life being lost. But let's be very clear. This isn't a tragedy that was caused by some sort of random circumstance. This is a tragedy that is the consequence of intentional human evil, an evil action. Okay, this is man's inhumanity to man. And so there are times when the word evil is appropriate to be used, and this is one of those times. And so don't be afraid to use theological words that have moral weight when what we are talking about are issues of moral weightiness. All right, so Senator John McCain added this. You recognize him as the Republican senator, or one of the Republican senators from Arizona. He's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He had this to say: "Otto Warmbier, an American citizen, was murdered by the Kim Jong-un regime. In the final year of his life, he lived the nightmare in which the North Korean people have been trapped for 70 years. Forced labor, mass starvation, systemic cruelty, torture, and murder. North Korea is threatening its neighbors, destabilizing the Asia-Pacific region, and rapidly developing the technology to strike the American homeland with nuclear weapons. Now it has escalated to brutalizing Americans, including three other citizens currently imprisoned in North Korea. The United States of America cannot and should not tolerate the murder of its citizens by hostile powers. Okay, here's the conversation that I think we as Christians have to be having in relationship to all of this. Senator McCain, and actually President Trump alludes to this as well, but Senator McCain just makes it absolutely clear. This is the nightmare in which the North Korean people have been trapped for 70 years. And so each and every time that we consider what happened to this young man, and there's a lot of speculation out there, actually what killed this young man? How in fact did this very robust, healthy 21-year-old actually get to the place where, we're now mourning his death? Here's the reality. From a Christian worldview, North Korea has been starving and beating its people to death for a very long time. The difference this time is that it was a young man born not in North Korea, but in North America. In fact, the United States of America. In fact, Ohio. That makes him ours. That makes him ours in a way that we don't think of the children of North Korea being ours. And so from a Christian worldview, the children of North Korea are equally as precious in God's sight as Otto Warmbier. But that's hard for us to think about. And that's just not the way that we think about these things. We think of him as an American. And we think that somehow that means his life is more valuable than the life of children in families who, frankly, are living under the tyranny of this dictatorship now for 70 years. I don't exactly know why we're wired this way, but it is true that our hearts beat somehow differently for the family of a boy born in Ohio than for the family of boys born in Pyongyang. Why is that? Well, it's because of our dual citizenship. We are not only citizens of the kingdom of heaven, we are not only brothers and sisters with all of those around the globe who call Jesus Christ Lord and are members of the household of faith. Those brothers and sisters with whom we're going to spend all eternity, people from every nation under heaven. But we also have a citizenship here on earth in the temporal reality. We are citizens of a country, and that country is called the United States of America. So here in the United States of America, we have labels for the kinds of things that are going on in North Korea. One of those labels has been applied to the situation of Christians and other religious minorities in the parts of the world where ISIS is seeking not only to retain control, but to extend its caliphate and extend its reach. And so you're going to recognize the word genocide. I don't know if some folks might have missed this last week, but in what is, it's important when there are bipartisan things that happen, right? It's important when the House of Representatives does anything unanimously. And so on June the 6th, the U.S. House of Representatives actually unanimously passed a bipartisan Iraq and Syria Genocide Emergency Relief and Accountability Act. And this is in response to the genocide that's taking place against Christians and Yazidis and other religious and ethnic minorities in that part of the world. And you say to yourself, well, I remember that we've talked about genocide. I remember that we've talked about that concept. Didn't the United States adopt that word and apply it to what's happening? Yes. But the reality is, unless there's actually a plan, which is what this Emergency Relief and Accountability Act it lists out, unless there's actually a plan, nothing actually happens other than you declare that something is genocide. So having declared that what is taking place is genocide and that there's an ongoing genocide in Iraq and Syria, and recognizing that the Christians and Yazidis living there have been crying out for help now for a number of years, we now have this bill authored by Chris Smith, Representative Chris Smith, who we've had on the program before. And here are the key provisions. They're gonna fund entities, including faith-based organizations that are actually effectively providing humanitarian aid on the ground to genocide survivors from religious and ethnic minorities under this persecution of ISIS. They're gonna assess and address the humanitarian vulnerabilities and needs that might force survivors to flee, which complicates the refugee situation that is already amplified not only in these places, but around the world. The list goes on. I'd encourage you to check it out. Again, it's the Emergency Relief and Accountability Act related to Iraq and Syria genocide. It was unanimously passed by the House of Representatives on June the 6th. and it's seeking to address the ongoing effects of genocide in the Middle East. Why bring this up today? Well, today happens to be World Refugee Day. And when we think about refugees, a lot of us hone in and think about Syrian refugees, refugees from the Syrian conflict. And certainly that civil war has produced notable, in fact, huge numbers, notable numbers of refugees. But get this, there are 65 million people displaced globally right now. 65 million people currently displaced around the globe. Now ask yourself, where are they going to get their daily bread? Where are they going to get their daily water? Where are they going to get their daily shelter? Where are their kids going to go to school? Where are they going to get even the most basic health care? Where are they going to find jobs? So when we think about people who are displaced by famine or war or terrorism, and we call them refugees, we have to recognize that they're just like you and me. And I want you to imagine for just a moment that you fled your home with whatever you could carry. And if you had little kids, what did you choose to carry? You chose to carry them. So you literally have nothing but the clothes on your back and the child in your arms. And everyone that you know in the entire world is also on the run. And you want the same thing that every parent in every generation and every nation under heaven wants: water, food, shelter, education, opportunity. Not so much for yourself, but for your child. So I just want to say today, no matter how you feel about immigration and borders, the conversation about offering refuge to people who are fleeing religious persecution, oppression, war, famine, or natural disaster is essential to our common humanity. We literally, in this case, must do unto others as we would have them do unto us if the situation were reversed. Hebrews 13:1-3 is a good reminder here. Continue in brotherly love. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for so by doing, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. Remember those in prison as if you were bound with them, and those who are mistreated as if you were suffering with them. All right, folks, we're going to have to leave that conversation there for just a moment, because I have waiting for me on the line right now Gina D'Alfonso. Gina is a writer and editor at Breakpoint. She's a columnist. She's been published in The Atlantic, Christianity Today, First Things, National Review, The Weekly Standard, which means you can read her all over the place. She's also the author of a new book called One by One, released today, hot off the presses. So this is very exciting, because any day that any author has a book released, I got to tell you, super exciting. Gina, so I'll get off my introduction here for just a second and go ahead and tell you, because you can appreciate this. Like, I have a sticky note, right, on my refrigerator with a date on it later this year. And you may have had today's date on a sticky note on your refrigerator for some period of time. All right, friends, she's the author of One by One, Welcoming the Singles in Your Church. And you can follow her on Twitter and communicate with her at Gina D'Alfonso. That's D-A-L-F-O-N-Z-O. Gina, welcome to the Reconnect.
Thank you so much.
So did you have a sticky note, like, on your refrigerator, on your wall, with this date on it?
Not actually a sticky note, but the date has been looming over me for a long time.
Yeah, so it's so great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk about single adults. The reality is single adults now outnumber married adults in the United States. I think that that might surprise people just to know that fact, but when you start thinking about it, it's not really all that surprising. We have never marrieds. We have single again for various and sundry reasons. But none of that reality is reflected in our church programming. Why is that?
Well, it seems to me that the church is not quite mentally and emotionally ready to deal with that fact. I think we sometimes tend to think of all this singleness as a terrifying and a bad thing. We talk about the sin of delaying marriage. We talk about all these horrible things that come with singleness. But I don't think we need to think of it that way, because single people are just another group of people who need the church and whom the church needs. And we are just another group of people that the church can minister to, just like families are. So I think the church needs to reframe the way it thinks about this issue, and then it will be more ready to say, okay, there are a lot of single people coming in our doors. How do we reach out to them? What do we do? How do we get them integrated here so that they're a part of the life of the church?
Good. So you interviewed a lot of single Christians. You yourself are a single Christian, mm-hmm. but you interviewed a lot of other single Christians while writing this book.
Yes.
What are some common themes that you discovered in that process?
Well, I talked to a lot of people who felt that there wasn't really any place for them in the church. And these were people who wanted to be at church. They were dedicated Christians. They wanted to serve. They wanted to get involved. They wanted to have relationships with others. But sometimes the church could get so family-centered, and I'm not necessarily saying support for families is a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. But the church could get so family-centered that it would start pushing the single people aside and making them feel like you don't belong here, there's no time for you, there's no place for you, your needs are not as important. They basically felt invisible, not recognized. And so there was a lot of frustration there.
Hmm. All right, so if there's a pastor listening right now, what is one thing that you feel like they need to know about the singles who are in the pews and in their congregation that they may not know?
Well, I think it would be good for them to know that we're not asking that you start ignoring the married people and just concentrating on us. That would be going too far in the other direction. We want some balance. We have sat through a lot of sermons on marriage and family. We would like to hear some sermons on how to deal with our singleness and how we can live fully for Christ in this stage of our lives and how others around us can help us to do that. And I would like to say that my pastor has done really well in this area at the church that I attend here in Northern Virginia. But there are so many other single people who have never heard anything like that. I just talked to a woman the other day who said her pastor was planning to preach on singleness, and then he changed his mind because he felt like people didn't really need that. And she felt so hurt because it's not just about we want all the focus for ourselves, we want the spotlight for ourselves. It's not like that. It's that everybody has certain needs. Everybody is in a certain place in their life where they need to hear how God can use them and how God wants them to live. And so when the default is married people all the time, that shouldn't be the default. There shouldn't be any default. There should be a recognition that different groups need to hear different things and just at least an effort to try to reach them.
So even as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, pastors who are listening and they're preaching through books of the Bible and they're saying to themselves, I don't preach series on subjects. I preach scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, think of all of the characters in the Bible who are single.
Yeah.
or who, at least for a period of life, right, are single. And so even if we were just to state that fact and recognize that about them, that we were, we were saying of Daniel, as we are celebrating everything else about him, as we're talking about who Daniel is, I mean, the reality is Daniel never marries. Mm-hmm. Daniel is taken from his homeland and his family as a very young man. And certainly the life that he then was assigned in Babylon would not have included the opportunity to ever marry. So we think about that, and you think about Joseph. You think about Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Clearly, they were all adults, and they were siblings, and they were still all living together. So they were clearly not married.
Right.
Anyway, it's just kind of interesting is when you even just allow your mind to sort of roam across the stories of Scripture and the narratives of the people who are found to be quite faithful, right? But
right.
They are very faithful in their singleness. And so
right.
I do think there are certainly ways for pastors to be celebrating those things. Okay, so let's talk about the myths.
Mm-hmm.
Just let us in on some of the myths about being a single Christian, and then just go ahead and dispel the myth.
Well, one very prominent myth is that singles are selfish people. You do tend to hear that message creeping through the church in all sorts of ways. You know, they don't have spouses and children to think about when you're talking about childless singles. So they must be selfish. And that is just ignoring so much of what it might be true of any given single person's life. A single person may be selflessly serving in the church on a regular basis. A single person may be taking care of his or her elderly parents or sick parents or other sick family members, may be looking after nephews, nieces, godchildren, may be doing selfless things in all kinds of ways. But we are stuck in this paradigm where the only way you can know selflessness is if you have a family, meaning a spouse and children, and that is just not true. And I realize that having a spouse and children is an excellent way to be drawn outside yourself and to learn to be unselfish. That is pretty much a guaranteed way, but it's not the only way, and we need to learn that when we're learning how to relate to singles, because if you start with the assumption, well, here I am talking to this selfish person who can't understand my own life of selfless service, then you're starting in a bad place, and you need to get that out of your head and just get to know single people for who they are and understand that they may be selfless too, and they are not just these self-contained, self-sufficient, solitary units that have nothing in common with you.
Mm. Hey, friends, we're talking to Gina D'Alfonso. The book is One by One, Welcoming the Singles in Your Church. And one of the things that I liked about this is really an invitation to a bigger view of God's family. This is it's really an invitation to see the household of faith as a household that includes not just married people with kids, because I even think that, you know, childless couples sometimes feel much the same way that singles feel in terms of your description of, you know, they're not part of the targeted programming of the church. And so I think there's a lot to learn about the various life experiences that people have and how we might do a better job within our local congregations, really having this expansive view of God's family. Before we have to go to a break, just give folks who are listening who might be married, just give them some ideas about how married couples could be more welcoming and inclusive of single people.
Well, that's a great question, and I have to start with saying that I know that married couples, especially married couples with children, are often very pressed for time, and I don't discount that. I don't take that lightly. That's a very important fact about their lives. Now, that being said, I would say look for ways to incorporate the single people into your lives the same way you would with other married couples at the church. We do, time constraints notwithstanding, we do tend to find ways to draw people into our lives that we have things in common with, so parents will get together with other parents and so forth. But when you think about it, there's really no reason you can't start including single people in that group. And, you know, if you're spending the day with family and friends, maybe invite them along. Let them play with your kids. Let them come to your kids' recitals. A lot of us love doing stuff like that. And it's just, again, it takes some rethinking. It takes a conscious effort, but you can find ways to make time and make room in your life for single people who really, really need those relationships.
I love it. All right, Gina, thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect. Folks, go out there. The book is One by One, Welcoming the Singles in Your Church. Don't just buy this and give it to a single person. That's not the idea. All right? We want churches reading this. We want small groups reading this. We want folks expanding their view of God's family and including single people more effectively in the life and ministry of God's household of faith. So she's Gina D'Alfonso. You can find her on Twitter at Gina D'Alfonso, D-A-L-F-O-N-Z-O. Gina, thanks for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thank you so much.
All right, friends. So I think that like all ministries that you hear on the radio, we pay to be on the air. And so this is not cheap. You might say to yourself, well, I didn't know that. Well, this is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. So if you enjoy what you're hearing and you want us to be able to not only continue to speak into your life, but into the lives of others, go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and become a ministry partner today. We're going to be right back here in just a moment. This is The Reconnect. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect, and indeed, Christ is the cure. We are seeking here to put God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. We invite you to join us in doing that at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We want to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, and that means we're talking about what people are talking about, and we're talking with the people who can help equip us in that direction. And one of those people is my good friend and colleague in ministry, John Stonestreet. Now, you recognize him as the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, the co-host with Eric Metaxas of Breakpoint, which is a Christian Worldview radio program founded by the late, great Chuck Colson. John has authored a lot of books. The latest one is A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. You can check John out and the things that he's writing about and talking about at breakpoint.org. And you can also follow him on Twitter at JB Stonestreet. John, my friend, welcome to The Reconnect.
Hey, Carmen, how you doing?
Well, I am doing great. How is life with a new baby in the house?
You know, we can't complain. And we have a lot of friends who have a new baby, and they're not getting any sleep. But little Hunter is giving us some good sleep at night. And my three daughters, his big sisters, are in love. And so it's been a lot of fun to watch.
I love it. I'm so happy for you all, and it's such a joy. All right, let's talk about this new book. You have authored and co-authored a few books on culture. What makes this one different?
Well, you know, with this one, it's really trying to meet a felt need. I mean, as a parent, Brett, my co-author, and I, you know, kind of, it's hard to keep up with everything that's happening in culture, and especially those things that impact our kids. And so we really aimed this book A, to be practical, but B, to really be aimed at those folks who are invested in the next generation. So parents and teachers and mentors. I mean, it can seem like, you know, as we're trying to keep up with what's happening in the lives of our students, that it's just happening too fast, but, you know, to keep up. But letting them just walk into this culture without any guidance or mentoring whatsoever, I mean, that's not an option either. And so we wanted to kind of give a guidebook just to help everyday parents and mentors, teachers, grandparents, give them some resources that they need to understand the issues that are at stake when it comes to the next generation.
So, I mean, even just in a week, like, I could just rattle off a half a dozen different experiences where I'm thinking to myself, I probably need to go read the chapter in the book on this particular subject. So we're shopping for a card for a wedding, and all of a sudden now in the wedding card section, there's the groom and groom cards, and there's the bride and bride cards. And I'm standing there with an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. And if you haven't already had those conversations with them, you're going to end up having them right there in the Hallmark store.
Well, listen, if you don't have the conversations with them, the culture is going to have the conversations with them. And so the option, we don't always have the option of kind of bailing out of some of these issues. And we wanted to frame all of these issues and within that larger truth that we know that no matter how crazy it gets in the card section or the Supreme Court, Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. And so that's the framework that we always have to approach culture with. And at the same time, knowing that, you know, hiding from culture isn't an option, because there's going to be a moment, you know, like we had in Beauty and the Beast. And if it's not there, it's going to be a moment in the card section or a moment on the commercial or a moment with their friends or a family member or maybe even an older sibling that makes an announcement of a lifestyle decision or choice or something like that. We've got to be ready.
Well, and John, and again, friends, I'm talking with John Stonestreet. The book is A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. But let me tell you, even if you don't consider yourself right now in a position to be speaking into the life of the next generation, it's a practical guide to living in the realities of today's world. So it's useful, a useful tool for everybody. John, it just occurs to me that we do not go through a day without the need to actively and intentionally integrate the Christian worldview into the realities of life. And so you've designed this to be a practical guide. Talk with us about what makes this practical for people.
Well, it's practical in two senses. I mean, the first thing is look, some of us who are an older generation than the current kind of teenagers, we've seen some of these dramatic shifts take place in our culture. It feels like our culture is in great upheaval. And so it's easy to kind of throw our hands up and so on. But our kids don't know any different. Our kids don't know, you know, they've never lived in a culture in which same-sex marriage or transgenderism wasn't considered normal. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish. And for many kids, culture is like the water that they're swimming in. They haven't noticed anything different. So one of the first practical things we wanted to do is kind of give an explanation of kind of where we are. If you can kind of think of a map that says, you know, you are here. We wanted to give an explanation of what some of these major shifts have been. And so kind of keeping on with that water motif, you know, if you're standing beside the seashore, you get hit by a wave, you know it. And so we deal in the third section of the book with these what we call cultural waves, you know, pornography, racism, transgenderism, you know, living in a culture of affluence and too much entertainment and glowing rectangles. I mean, these are the issues that as parents we feel. We feel those waves pound against the hearts and minds of our kids. But you've also probably had that experience, Carmen, of being in the ocean and looking up and suddenly finding yourself 20, 30 yards down the beach. And you're like, how did that happen? Well, you didn't feel it, but an undercurrent took you there. Mm-hmm. One of the most practical things we need to understand about culture are those undercurrents, the unseen shifts when it comes to things like information, when it comes to things like maturity and adolescence, when it comes to things, identity. These are kind of the unspoken dramatic shifts that our culture is. So one of the first practical things we did is just kind of highlight what those things are. You know, what has created the cultural waves that we feel. The other part of that of the book that Carmen, I think, is practical is just really like, okay, when it comes to these very specific issues, what can you talk about with your kids? How do you address these issues? How do you get up ahead of them when it comes to issues like identity or sexuality? What needs to be in place before that moment hits? And in a very practical way, we just kind of lay out a very hopeful way forward for parents to help their kids navigate these cultural waters.
All right, friends, again, the book is A Practical Guide to Culture. The authors are John Stonestreet and Brett Kunkel. We have John on today. We're going to have the privilege of having Brett on this Friday, so that's a conversation you won't want to miss. This is a book about helping the next generation navigate today's world. And so if you're a person who's thinking to yourself, wow, I have really in my life needed someone else to come alongside me and help me understand not only how we got here, but where we are now, and then help me be able to speak into the life of the next generation. It might be my child. It might be my grandchild. It might be a niece or nephew. It might be the kids in your Sunday school class. It might be, the neighborhood kids. We had an attorney on, and we're at this conversation about the need for kids to even understand what it means to like basically respect a police officer. And if they're not learning basic respect in their own home and they're not learning any kind of submission to authority in that environment, man, translating that suddenly out there in the world where respect of authority is going to be essential to them surviving an encounter with law enforcement, you know, these are not things that go, they go unsaid too often, and we can no longer allow them to go unsaid.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And half of it is just realizing what's going on. I mean, one of the most devious trends in our culture, in fact, Senator Ben Sasse has written a book about it and also wrote in the Wall Street Journal about it in an article that was titled the same thing as our chapter in the book.
I know, I saw that. I'm like, did he steal your chapter title on perpetual adolescence?
Well, listen, ours was already sent to the publisher, so we didn't steal it from him, I can guarantee you that. But no, you know, this idea of perpetual adolescence, it's amazing to realize that we live in a culture that doesn't expect kids to grow up, and to also just realize that the whole idea of adolescence itself is quite new in world history. And most cultures throughout the history of the world, kids went from being kids to being an adult. Now they go from being kids to being adolescents. But what's happening is they're entering adolescence at an earlier stage and remaining in it longer and longer and longer. Most people don't think adolescence is 13 to 18 anymore. Most researchers would put it more like 11 to 30. And when you start talking about young men who don't grow up and the delaying, delaying of marriage and some of these indicators of adulthood, these are significant trends in the lives of our kids. These are something that, you know, they're not felt waves. These are kind of the undercurrents, you know, one of the undercurrents that you're just like, why won't kids actually grow up? And how can I get ahead of that with my own student? And that's one of the, I think, most important chapters in the book. And not only because we want kids to survive culture, but we want kids to follow Christ and be a champion of truth in culture. And that's a great place to start, because if Christian kids are the mature ones, if they're not the adolescents, but they're acting like young adults instead of perpetual teenagers, then all of a sudden we've got a generation of leaders that are ready to tackle some of the more important issues in culture. And so, you know, that's one of the things we wanted to inspire and also instruct in this book, is not only how to survive culture, but how to actually mentor the next generation to take their God-given role and making a difference in culture and becoming a restorer and an influencer in the cultural moment.
So Katy Perry comes to mind. I've been reading several things about her lately. And, you know, she is a person who, you know, by her own, the own witness of her family, like, she's raised in a Christian home. Her parents did everything right. If there's a way to cook a kid, right, follow the recipe and cook a kid to turn out like they should, they did it, right? They followed all the rules. They did all the things that they should. And she adopted this other personality. Katy Perry's not her given name. So she adopted this other identity. She's now come out in very dramatic testimony in a counseling setting that they made public, and said, look, I I deal with depression and suicidal tendencies because I'm not the person who I know I am. I'm living in the world as something that I'm not. And she goes on to say, this is amazing, John. It's only by the grace of God that I don't take my own life. And so there's, you know, I do want to give some hope to parents today who have a kid who is not at this stage of the game, aligning their life with the Christian worldview that was advocated for in their home. Instead, it's a child that has gone the way of the culture. So talk with us about how you speak into the life. Where would you start a conversation with a kid who's really right now a child of the culture, who we're trying to woo back to being a child of the church?
Yeah, that's a hard one. And I think it's so important to remember that, you know, there's not a recipe in our book. There's not a, you know, a one size fits all. I'm always kind of deeply bothered when, you know, I come across a book that kind of guarantees an outcome, especially when you're talking about, you know, another human being like a spouse or a kid. It just doesn't work that way. But there is a lot of things that we can do to get ahead of the culture. I mean, one of the things that the Katy Perry story brings up is one of the issues we deal with, and that's affluence. It's amazing how many parents will move their kids out of a poor neighborhood in order to keep them, quote unquote, safe, and move them, according to statistics, into an environment that's so driven by the culture that things like depression and suicide and risky sexual behavior and antisocial activity, you know, statistically is just as bad in affluent neighborhoods as it is in impoverished neighborhoods. And that's one of the things we deal with in the book. But your question was about what do you say to that parent who's dealing with a prodigal up front. And it's one of the most painful things. One of the first things I think you can say is, listen, no matter you know, what kids have determined reality is still what reality is. And that's an important thing to remember. As Christians, we kind of think like we're somehow playing on, you know, the enemy turf. No. This is our Father's world. And so the rules still apply. And that's what you actually hear in Katy Perry's admission in that video that's now gone viral, is that she realizes that something has gone wrong. She's not the person that she wants to be. She still lives in a world where the moral law is written on our hearts, and that the creation screams God's glory. And humans are really, really, really good at suppressing those things, but they still exist nonetheless. The second thing that we said we want to actually, in terms of a strategy, is that so often the battle for our kids' hearts and minds have to do with the definition of words. And very often when it comes to kids who are prodigals, we want to be quick to give an answer, an answer, an answer, an answer. And I'm always struck with how Jesus dealt with skeptics, which is by far more giving questions than answers. And one of the most important questions I think we can have ready to go with our kids is a simple question: what do you mean by that? You know, this is getting at the definition of terms. I think so often, especially when we're dealing with prodigals, but I think it's just true with our kids in general, that we find ourselves using the same vocabulary, but we're actually using a different dictionary. So when we say truth and they say truth, when we say love and they say love, when we say marriage and they say marriage, and one of the things you want to get at is, what do you mean when you say marriage or truth or freedom or love or happiness or whatever? And this is a way to create a dialogue about whether your kid actually has the right idea about words like God. I remember once being on an airplane, Carmen, with a woman, a skeptic, and she heard what I did. We were having a conversation. She's like, how can you believe in God? And, you know, I've been trained as an apologist. I had the 5, you know, proofs from Aquinas about why God exists. But I started just by saying, well, wait a minute. What do you mean by God? And she's like a grumpy old man with a beard in the sky who can't wait for you to do something wrong so he can strike you with a lightning bolt. And I was like, well, good heavens, lady. I don't believe in Zeus. I'm not going to defend his existence, right? In other words, I would have been defending a completely wrong notion of God. And I think that's oftentimes the case with our own kids. It's a great strategy, by the way, when you're watching a movie and the good guy is the good guy, the bad guy is the bad guy in the movie, and you realize, well, wait a minute, they've got this backwards, you know, which happens in a lot of films. You say, well, wait a minute, what do they mean by good? What do they mean by kind of a justifiable action there? Just asking good questions with your kids creates dialogue instead of monologue, and I think it's a good way into that which is capturing their imagination.
All right, I could talk with you all day. You know that. I love what you're doing. I love the way God is using you. And I appreciate just every moment of your ministry. So, friends, this is John Stone Street. He's the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You can hear him at Breakpoint. That's the show. Breakpoint.org is the site. You can follow him on Twitter at JB Stone Street. And the book is A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. We're going to pick up this conversation again on Friday with John's co-author, Brett Kunkel. John, thank you so much for joining us again today on The Reconnect.
Hey, you bet. Thanks so much, Carmen. Appreciate everything that you do.
All right, friends, he's one of my favorites. If you're not already, just following him around, he is a good person. If you are seeking to grow up in every way into Christ, there's a guy who can disciple you, even if from a distance. So it's one of my all-time favorites. All right, definitely the point in the show where I got to dive below the fold. It's obviously we're going to have to make it a quick one today. This is when we lift up stories and make connections designed to help you start and engage with others in conversations that on the surface certainly don't appear to be about God, but where you're going to have the opportunity to introduce eternal principles that might change not only the course of the conversation, but another person's thinking and living. We actually just did that a little bit with John during that conversation. And so you can talk about currents. You can talk about rip currents. You can talk about undercurrents and the undertow. There's just all kinds of fodder that God's given you right there at the beach this week. Even the footprints that you're going to leave in the sand, they're only going to be there for a moment. And that's a great opportunity to have a conversation about the ever-changing nature of culture or the impact that we have versus the reality of the sands of time. All right. My below the fold today comes from the National Review, and it just leads off with this sentence. The United States is currently the world's oldest democracy. Now, you could just stop right there. This is by Victor Davis Hanson. He's a professor out in California. He's super smarty pants. And this piece on whether or not a divided America can actually survive is an excellent, excellent piece. It's worth your reading in its entirety. But the lead sentence is worth stopping and having a conversation about. The United States is currently the world's oldest democracy. Think about that. The world's oldest democracy is only 241 years old. And that's just not very old when you start talking about the age of nations and as long as things have been around and things have been going on. So you think about the Middle East and you think about just how long the conflicts between people groups have been going on in that part of the world. And you're saying to yourself, well, we read about them all the way back in the Old Testament, frankly, very early in the Old Testament. So we're talking about thousands upon thousands of years ago. And so when we, as the oldest democracy in the world, we're still just a baby, 241 years old. And I think we got to let that sink in a little bit. And we have to recognize that America, as an experiment, is not immune from the kind of collapse that every other consensual government in all of human history has suffered. So the Athens Republic, Republican Rome, Renaissance Florence, Venice, some of the elected governments of the early 20th century in Western European states, eventually they all destroyed themselves. They went bankrupt and they were overrun by invaders. We are not immune to any of that. And so when you get to thinking that this is the way that it has always been in America, first of all, that's not true. And when you start thinking this is the way that it's always going to be, that's not true. The truth about the one who is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, that's just one truth. That's God. God alone is the one who is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. God is the one who holds the whole world in his hands. God is the one who is sovereign over every speck of dust and earth that you and I recognize as a part of the universe. God's the one who's sovereign over the dark matter that nobody knows how to describe. Right? It's no surprise to God, the seven planets that NASA suddenly has discovered in the Goldilocks zone that might be enough like Earth to, you know, that humans could actually live there. Even though they're so far away, we could never get there. We'd die on the way. God's God there too. God is God yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He's unchanging. He's unflappable. He's not an experiment. And so when John Stone Street talks about the rules still applying, God's grace still being the real thing, that is what we have to constantly be reminding ourselves of when we are reading things about division, when we're reading things about reconciliation, when we are reading that people in America are as divided as they've ever been, maybe no less divided today than in the days leading up to the Civil War, when people are talking about secession from from the union, when people are talking about taking up arms against one another, or when people are actually doing that, failing for their viewpoint to be heard at the ballot box, and so they take, you know, so they can't get what they wanted from a ballot, so they're going to try to get it through a bullet. That's not a solution. That is not a solution in a country where deliberative conversation, civil discourse, has been the path to becoming who we are. So if you look at the United States of America today, the reality is we are divided. You could think of it as red and blue. On some occasions, you could think of it as black and white. There are challenges that we face today as a nation that we have got to talk our way through. We have got to sit down with one another, recognizing the humanity of the other, and actually work our way to a place where, you know, together we can have a bright future. Here's the reality. Half of the country is concentrated in just a very few counties. So there's 146 counties in America. There's 3,000 counties in America. In 146 of them, half of the people live, and those are blue counties, which means that there's just an overwhelming landmass in America where, you know, where folks are not liberal, right? So that's where the conservatives live. Those are the red states. That's the interior. Geographically, culturally, economically, politically, socially, even when it comes to the things of faith, we are at odds with blue state America. And so it becomes this coastal interior thing. We watch different news. We read different books. We listen to different radio programs. Increasingly, we're living our lives in two different traditions or two different directions. Now, you're saying to yourself, well, that's not very hopeful. Well, folks, we're going to have to place our hope in one place. And we're going to have to be people of reconciliation. As ministers of reconciliation, the people who actually know Jesus are going to have to be leading the reconciliation conversations in this nation. I hear over and over and over again that we need new leadership. We need leaders who are going to rise up. They're going to speak as those who have authority, and they're going to lead people to the positive possible future that God intends. Well, let me just go ahead and tell you right now, those are going to be Christians. And so, if you're hearing somebody and you think to yourself, that's a person whose voice should be heard in other places by other people, that's a voice we need to be lifting up. That's a reconciler. My guess is it's going to be a Christian. And it's not just a person whose political views always align in one direction. Let me just go ahead and tell you, it's probably not going to work out that way. All right, friends, the culture is complicated, but Christ is on the throne, and he's not going to be moved from it. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. We'd appreciate it if you donate to the ministry. We got other people we want to be talking to, but the only way that that's possible is if people support the ministry. So go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, share today's show with someone new, have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.